The spare changers came from outer space. The spare changers came from outer space, underneath the grime of the no public restrooms. Those weather-worn skins are green. The spare changers sleep in flying saucers at night. The cops have been enforcing force fields to fight the panhandling peril from other planets. The spare changers have unfair superior technology. They just look at you and it's too late. Their eyes are like that. Strange constellations burn where your conscience used to be. Their blood is made of the tears you locked away, but they haven't been locked away yet, and it's certainly a plot. Those shapeless freebox raincoats are patched with rain and hide as many extra arms as a tentacled monster, all empty-handed and spoiling the view. Alien, unnatural invaders shambling and shuddering in mud-stained shoes from the bottom of a Martian canal. The space warp shifts behind their faces like a four-dimensional stutter. The spare changers are incomplete Lazaruses with laser gun glares whose galaxy exploded behind them. There's a black hole in their hearts where everything went away. Lost. All lost. The spare changers came from outer space. After all, we'd never let humans live like this.
And that was Julia Vinograd, Eye of the Hand, her audio album. Julia's a poet from Berkeley. I often read on this show. And you're listening to Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, Civil Rights for the Poor, here in Santa Cruz and around the country. My name is Robert Norse. I'm going to be with you for the next 2 hours. This show is recorded on April 12th, and you should be reaching you on April 13th. Every Sunday at 11 o'clock, we have a Civil Rights for the Poor show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. And I'm your host. Today, although active civil rights folks may be out on the streets supporting United Farm Workers in Watsonville, those of you who haven't been able to make it will be able to listen to the show and perhaps a rerun of the show later on in the week. We have an interview with Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs activist in San Francisco, on the ongoing scandal in the San Francisco Police Department after the murder of police officer Aaron Williams and the whitewashing of one of the killers, Mark Andaya, a police officer in San Francisco. We have numerous interviews from the streets of Santa Cruz, and we have lots of stuff from the San Jose Sit-Lie Ordinance hearings, which happened last Tuesday in San Jose at the city council there. At that council meeting, the council voted 9-2 for a first reading of a law which makes it illegal for homeless people to sit down within a 66-block area in the central city, except in parks, at bus stops, and in pay cafes. A similar law is under consideration in Santa Barbara, California, and will be coming up for a first reading next Tuesday, April 15th. Santa Barbara law only deals with the main street, State Street, similar to Santa Cruz's Pacific Avenue, as the Palo Alto Sit-Lie Law, which passed last month, and it goes into effect April 24th, only deals with University Avenue. The point being that the merchants have no problems about driving homeless people away from the main drag, but are afraid that they will encounter constitutional difficulties in banning sitting more broadly or banning panhandling more broadly, things of that sort. So we're going to be doing a lot of analysis of that issue. Here are some arguments pro and con. And you'll learn what you can do to help support those who are resisting these laws. And what that is, of course, is mainly coming to demonstrations to oppose the laws, calling or faxing or writing the city councils that are considering these ordinances for final readings in San Jose. That's going to be in a couple of weeks. In Mountain View, there's an ordinance coming up, already passed on Tuesday, but coming up for another reading, which makes it illegal to hold up a sign or solicit, as they put it, near a roadside or a parking lot. Again, the attempt being to get rid of the unsightly homeless people under the pretext of traffic problems. Some of the San Jose hearing was covered by local television. I actually spoke at the hearing, as did others, including Becky Johnson from Santa Cruz, Scott Wagers from the San Jose Community Homeless Alliance. And later in the show, we'll hope to play some of those cuts if we can find them. We're going to skip back now to Keith McHenry, Food Not Bombs activist in San Francisco, who's probably suffered more police harassment single-handedly than almost any other person I know, and yet continues to show up publicly jovially and caustically, as he did at this police commission hearing, which he's going to report to us on. In San Francisco, the police commission is the body that can control and discipline the police department. Unlike the Santa Cruz Citizens Police Review Board, it has disciplinary powers and isn't too inclined to use them, but let's hear Keith's analysis of what happened in the case of Mark Andaya, a police officer accused of abusing, indeed helping to kill, a black man, Aaron Williams, 2 years ago. Keith McHenry.
Yes.
You were at a police commission hearing on Wednesday in the case of police officer Mark Andaya, who again showed up like a bad penny, or actually I guess he didn't show up personally, right?
Right, he did not show up, no. Nor did Mr. Collins, his attorney, show up.
Now, briefly tell us what Andaya did that has aroused the ire of the community, what the police commission has done so far, and then give us a description of what happened at the meeting.
Well, what happened, the issue is that Mark Andaya was the first person on the scene, in fact, arrived at Aaron Williams' house before the person called in a report to say that they had been burglarized. There was a person that called in and said that...
So this was the Aaron Williams case that happened, what, in 1995?
Yeah, 1995.
Years ago, Aaron Williams was arrested for burglary, beaten, pepper sprayed, and then died either before or on the way to the hospital, right?
Correct. He was actually... And Andaya was the first guy on the scene, like I say. And in fact, the first guy on the scene, according to...
Officer Andaya was one of the first officers there.
Right, and he was admitted to, I went to the police commission hearing where his lawyer said that he had kicked him eight or nine times as hard as he could in the head, and then he pepper sprayed him, and three other officers also pepper sprayed Aaron, and had his hands tied behind his back, and was thrown into a paddy wagon. Now, the eyewitnesses believe that he was dead at that time. There's approximately 30 people watching this incident happen.
Williams was a black man, right?
The black man, 35 years old, had been on parole. And
continuing, Keith, you say that that Officer Andaya, well, so you were saying that Williams was thought to be dead by many of the crowd. This happened where?
This happened on Bush Street in the Richmond, really the Western Addition, but part of the Richmond Police Precinct.
This is a black area?
And it's a black neighborhood, correct. And the Bowsers owned their own home at that out where Aaron was, and he was had been not technically he was raised by his aunt in that house, and his family watched him be killed. And then there was a lot of protests after that.
I understand also on the way to the, because I too attended one of these police commission hearings, on the way to the hospital, his breathing, if he was breathing, was obstructed by a mask that was put on him to stop him from spitting or some such thing?
They put a surgical mask over his face. It is believed that was probably put on during the between 20 and 30 minutes that he spent in the back of... people believe that the police washed him up and cleaned him up before they called the paramedics. And when the paramedics arrived, they were the cops were pretending like they were trying to resuscitate him, and it was something that just had happened.
In other words, he was... actually, not in other words, but I believe another thing I saw happening at that hearing, which I came to in February, was that there was testimony that there was a long delay. He wasn't taken to the nearest hospital.
In fact, they took him in a paddy wagon to the police precinct. Now, there is an emergency room across the street, or at that time there was an emergency room across the street from the police precinct. There's also an ambulance company that was...
So was he taken directly to that emergency room?
He didn't go by any of the emergency rooms. There was three emergency rooms within three blocks of his, of where he was killed, and there was also one, the whole, like a dispatch center for an ambulance company is one block away. So none of those people were called, and when he was declared by the paramedics that he was dead, they tried to revive him, but it turned out he was dead. Now then, there's been two pathologists that have done two different reports. One is the police pathologist who has said a whole bunch of different stories about whether you know, he's saying that he probably died of cocaine overdose, that kind of stuff. Although the other pathologist that was hired by the family says there's no evidence of that. And in fact, the family who was with Aaron moments before this happened, it says that there was no, you know, they were with him.
There was no cocaine.
It's not like he's died from this cocaine asphyxia type of.
Now, the family has sued the police department or the city?
They have sued them, yes.
And as I understand it, Mark Andaya, one of the officers, actually there are a number of officers involved, but is he the most prominent, and if so, why?
Well, he is the person that people are most concerned about because he has killed another person over in Oakland before this, Jerry Stilts,
when he was part of the Oakland Police Department?
He was an Oakland police officer, and he also has a number of other discipline problems where he was a complaint was sustained when he called somebody a black ass nigger, and one, he was beating him and kicking him in the testicles, and he's had a whole series of cases some of which were found against him already before he left the Oakland Police Department, but some that were pending, and he lied about that on his application.
Now, did he leave the Oakland Police Department under a cloud?
Yeah, he did leave, but he made no reference to that in his application to the San Francisco Police. Now, the people reviewing Andaya's case on whether to, I mean, reviewing his record on whether to hire him and so on the department, recommended that he not be hired. That ruling was overruled by the chief, then Anthony Robera. We call him Blowjob Robera because he was caught forcing prostitutes to give him blowjobs in the Tenderloin while in a patrol car.
Is he still the...
That was a big problem. But anyway, that guy overruled the recommendations of the hiring committee, had Andaya hired, and Andaya seems to be apparently a part of this whole cadre of officers. He was a plainclothes cop at the time of his killing of Aaron Williams, and he was that his friends, this huge crew of white, about 130 white police officers in plain clothes, showed up to a police commission meeting to support him.
Before we get to that meeting, and I do want you to describe it, let me again ask you a couple of, or kind of summarize. In San Francisco, you have a situation where you have an Office of Civilian Complaints, which is where people are kind of the so-called Citizen Police Review Board, and then you actually have the people with the real power, which is the police commission itself, which can actually discipline officers. Is that right?
Well, that's the theory. That's the above-ground theory.
But in fact, they don't really use that power?
Well, last Wednesday's police commission meeting, it was a classic example. It could not have shed more light on the fact that actually the commission does not control anything. It doesn't even control its own office or anything. And that's basically it. And the chief of police controls nothing, and the deputy chief controls nothing. It's this gang that controls things.
So in other words, you're saying that though there was a new administration under Mayor Brown, to change the police chief and the deputy police chief, the real power lies with Andaya's gang of middle management folks and the on-the-beat vigilante types?
Right, the beat cops, but also there are high-ranking people in that cadre and that are involved. In fact,
and that was Keith McHenry of San Francisco's Food Not Bombs. We'll hear more from him in a later interview. That last interview is from late March, and we have one as recently as a few days ago. But now let's skip around Santa Cruz and give you some on-the-spot interviews with local folks. Talking to an employee of
San Lorenzo Lumber.
And you're a regular worker here and see the...
Well, you're not going to get me in trouble with this, are you?
You're under arrest. You see the folks gathering out front, right, on the sidewalk, looking for work in the morning?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I do.
And how long have you worked here yourself?
A long time.
Like 5 years?
At least.
And have you noticed a change in the population? Has it increased over the last few years, decreased?
I would say it has increased, of people out of work, or looking for work, anyway.
And any observations on how many folks actually get work of the crowd that hangs out?
It's hard to say. I really don't watch them. I mean, I'm working.
Right.
So, I would say I really couldn't say. You'd have to really watch them to see how many guys get picked up during the day or whatever. And it's guys looking for a particular type of work. They're looking for labor that they can make a fairly decent wage on fairly quickly. Some guys are looking for, that I've talked to, are just looking to make some money so that they can have a good time. other guys are looking to make money to send back to their family if they're from, you know, out of the country, whatever.
Most of the workers are Hispanic or are they mixed?
It's mixed, but I'd say the majority is Hispanic.
Any women hang out here and seek work?
Very few. Once or twice I've seen women here looking for a job. Usually they're with somebody, a guy that they're either working with or are together with.
How about the age group? Are you mostly younger folks, older folks?
20 to 35, I'd say.
Younger group, pretty much. Meanwhile, up the road, Jim is selling Street Spirit. That's up in front of the Cinema 9 Theater, and has recently been encountering some harassment from the police department, perhaps involved in their traditional spring crackdown. Indeed, we're going to hear an interview, hopefully before the end of this two-hour show, from Sean Alimi, a Feed the People activist, a group that Sean is going to report on his first ticket of the year here in Santa Cruz for leaning against a railing or a pole out by Cathcart and Pacific. But let's hear Jim here.
I'm talking to Jim here right across from the Cinema 9 on Pacific Avenue. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing, Rob?
All right. So what's cooking down here? You gave me a call earlier, and here I am.
Yeah, I pretty much live on Pacific Avenue during the daytime, and I panhandle or distribute poetry or street newspapers to get by. And in the past and today, I've had problems with the police and kind of making up the rules as they go. Mm-hmm. I've been told a lot of different and conflicting things. One time I was told I couldn't panhandle in front of buildings. I could only panhandle in front of fences. Today I was told that my gear was spread out all over the sidewalk.
Your gear amounted to?
A small day pack and a sleeping bag that's rolled and inside a stuff sack.
Mm-hmm. So you have it with you, actually carrying the bag.
And my back strapped on my back.
Oh, it's pretty small there, Jim.
Yeah.
You live spartanly, I can see that.
I also take pains to be out of the way. Like, as you can see here, there's probably 10, 15 feet in front of me for people to walk by.
We're standing in front of the fence that separates the vacant lot that used to be the Cooper House.
Under arrest.
Uh-oh.
Again.
Jim Coster. Jim, this is Jim. Jim.
Hello, Jim
has just been hassled by police for panhandling. He's continuing.
He also said that my sign was excessive size. He told me that it couldn't be bigger than 12 by 14 inches approximately.
Now the sign, we're talking about the sign you have here in your book?
Yeah.
And what does that sign say?
Homeless, broke, need any work, spare any change.
I think they're trying to improve the vision of everybody to make them pay more attention by making microscopic signs.
Well, on the bottom I had the other flap from the cardboard box. It's gone now, that said, God bless you.
Okay.
Bye, Jim. The part down here I tore off said, God bless you.
Well, maybe there's a religious question here.
That could be, although I was under the impression that I have that freedom in America also.
This happened, about an hour ago?
Yeah, an Officer Lefevre, I believe his name is. Since I talked with you a while back, I've taken pains to note the names.
Has he been by again?
No, he hasn't. I kind of thought he would, but I haven't seen him.
Was he alone, or was he accompanied by another officer?
By himself.
Were any witnesses who observed this interaction with him?
I'm sure there were many, but as for locating them, I doubt it.
Now, you're not a man who takes a lot of time filing complaints with police. You haven't filed one before, have you?
Right? I have filed one in 1990.
So it was some time.
Yeah, and I believe it was...
Justified?
Yeah.
Who was the cop? What was the incident?
I don't remember his name, but as I was making a statement to a group of police officers supporting the police's action as I witnessed it, another officer tackled me from behind because a wrench was sticking out of my pocket, which he perceived to be a weapon.
What actually had the police done that you approved of back in 1990?
Well, I was managing a motel near the beach, and I had a tenant there that they were drunk and breaking windows and generally raising hell. I called the police, and one of the people involved, without provocation, attacked one of the police officers. And so I witnessed that and was making a statement regarding the incident to a police officer. And while I was doing that, another officer tackled me from behind and told me that I didn't have any respect and that he would be happy to beat it into me. And
completely misunderstood what you were doing, in other words.
Yeah, apparently he thought that I was one of the perpetrators.
This was before, of course, our fine Citizens Police Review Board that you may be going to visit tomorrow or the next day.
Yeah.
What was the result of your complaint at that point?
Well, I went in and called the sergeant, and he called me back, said that he had talked to the other officers that were there and witnessed it, and that they all concurred with my story and agreed with me. I said that an apology from the officer would be fine. I would forget the whole thing. He said he would talk to the officer involved and get back to me, which he did, and said the officer would not apologize, that he felt that nothing would be served by doing so. I told him I thought that if the cop did that, he could probably get the respect that he seemed to demand so urgently, you know. But as a result, I did go down and file a complaint against that officer.
I'm glad you did. In fact, a lawsuit might have been appropriate. It sounds completely unjustified on his part. And given your attempt to provide a mediated solution to the whole thing, even more unjustified.
Yeah, I thought it was more than reasonable about it.
Well, right now we have a situation where this officer Lefebvre, by your account, has, he instructed you to make the sign smaller, he instructed you to pack up put your stuff together. Again, you have only a very small sleeping bag and a backpack and a little cap and a book. What happened then?
He told me, I told him, you know, I'd be happy to make the sign smaller, and he said, well, why don't you just pick it up and leave?
I think just because there is a constitution in force, officer. If you want to arrest me, of course, you have your paddy wagon and your radio. I know you're a low-profile guy. You don't claim that kind of thing. But,
well, yeah. No, I mean, I didn't want to face arrest. He told me he would cite me if, you know, he said, I'm not going to cite you this time, but if I contact you again, I will. And now, in learning about this absence of infractions that I committed, that, you know, that he was making up, that maybe he couldn't have cited me, or maybe if he had cited me, they wouldn't have been any good. And maybe it was all a bluff. Maybe he was just trying to make me leave, you know.
It sounds like with the onset of all these new merchant obstructions, which of course are little commercial ventures that the merchants have, they're trying to spruce up the avenue with the onset of tourism by removing all people that they think might conceivably be less than credit card rich here.
This is true. Actually, I've never had a credit card, to my personal pride.
I'll give you credit for that.
But, I never thought I'd be homeless, never been homeless before. I don't think it's anything to be ashamed of. I'm not a good criminal.
Uh-huh. I agree.
But I believe I have a right to be, a right to exist, and a right to walk or sit on any sidewalk that anybody else can, just because I'm penniless. Doesn't mean I need to be delegated to a certain area or told that I can't be. I mean, it's bad enough that I'm not allowed to sleep.
Because of the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban?
Right. You know, I mean, I'm a human being. I have a biological need to sleep. To me, it's unfathomable that, you know, I'm a religious person. Many people are not. That's my personal thing. But many of our constitution and history of our country is based on the Bible, and it says one of the earliest things was security of a person's person, to be secure in their person. And I think that camping law it violates my person. It means that I cannot sleep just because I don't pay money to a landlord or...
It seems a deprivation of your almost your right to exist, since sleeping is an essential part of your well-being.
Yeah, similar to taxing breathing.
Right. Well, all right. Thank you, Jim. You're picking up all my papers that have flown all over the place. Anything you want to add about this Lefebvre sit on the sidewalk with a cap and a sign, go to jail incident? Get a ticket incident?
No, I just, you know, I try really hard to play by the rules, and I'm not aggressive. I'm very passive. I get along with most authority figures that I contact here, the mall hosts and whatnot. And I try really hard to play by the rules, and I wish that the police would play by the rules. I don't think making them up as you go is really fair.
Now, how's the business today? You've been telling me that... doesn't seem to be, in spite of all the tourists on the street, much in the way of incoming cash. They're spending all their money on high-priced dresses, or what's the story?
That I really can't tell you. I've been on the street over a year. I have good days. I have bad days.
Beautiful weather today. A lot of people. Sunday, but it's not a good day.
I wish I knew the secret, you know. If it was, I would probably be cut down a lot on the time that I'm out here. But
what do you make on an average day?
It really varies. As little as $2, as much as $20.
And how many hours are you out here per day on the average?
Average 6 to 8.
So that's an average of what? 15 or 20, 30 cents to $3 an hour. Not much of a wage for one of these rich welfare panhandlers we've heard.
No, actually, I received no assistance from the government of any way, shape, or form. Since they took away the Coral Street shelter, the city doesn't back me or the county or the state or the federal government in any way, shape, or form. I've lived in Santa Cruz County for 20 years, but my food stamps were cut off because I couldn't verify my residency. You know, it's another one of those things. Yeah, one thing I'd like to add is that I do appreciate having an advocate that I can call. When these things have happened to me in the past, I haven't known what to do. I'm a little bit leery of filing complaints with the police department, because then that brings the police department down on me for filing complaints. So it's good that I have a number I can call and get things like this documented. I really would urge everybody to do that.
That's 423 Huff, and the advocate, of course, is me, or whoever happens to be answering the phone at my end of the line. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Bob.
You're referring to this about a week and a half ago, where one of your companions, or I should say competitors, had a sign out, was seeking money, but not making any verbal requests after dark near the theater where you were selling the Street Spirit newspaper. What happened?
Police walked past me and didn't say anything. They did make a comment to me about something like they hadn't seen much of that in town. I think they were referring to the newspaper. They walked over to my friend and told him that he was panhandling. He said that he wasn't. He wasn't saying a word. And they said, well, you're holding a sign, so you are panhandling. Then they ran him, they asked for an ID, which he provided to them, and he had a warrant, and so I watched him get hooked up and taken away. His name's Kevin.
Has
Bland.
He been released? Or?
No, he's still in jail. It was a probation violation. The guy isn't no hardcore criminal or anything. I don't think he's ever done anything that would justify society spending the kind of money they're spending on him right now.
Well, there's a lot of people in jail for victimless so-called drug crimes, and then others for simply probation violations once they get hooked up on that shit, meaning the court system, not the drugs. The drugs are bad enough. The court system only compounds the problem, of course.
Yeah, Kevin's never hurt anybody. I mean, he was staying in a motel with people that were out stealing and robbing, and he left there because he didn't like that scene and that karma, and chose to go sleep under a bridge other than a warm motel room so that he would not be around those people.
Have you visited him in jail?
No.
Got an ID?
No, I don't have ID. That's all my stuff was stolen. Yeah. All my documents were taken.
It sounds like fun times down here on Pacific.
Another day.
Say, we're looking here at Patricia, who's actually a woman who's been to court to fight sleeping band tickets. I was there when she was. And she has a shopping cart and a lot of stuff that she sort of wheels around with her in a kind of a dense urban scene kind of style, which we don't find too much of in Santa Cruz. There are only a few folks with shopping carts I've seen that are really visible. You say the police have arrested her?
Well, from what I heard from Rennie, who runs a little Coney Island hot dog place up the street, that they did arrest her for stealing a shopping cart and actually hooked her up and took her away.
Wow. She still has the shopping cart, so...
I think that's one of those collapsible carts. I don't think that's...
Not the same one.
Yeah.
Well, I know a friend who has two shopping carts in her yard that the GAMP Safeway won't even pick up. So, it's, I guess it depends
really
on which side you're on.
Yeah, who's got them?
Yeah. Greetings! Patricia here. We're kind of relaxing on the bench right here at the Pacific and whatever the hell the street is, Locust or Church or something. What happened? You said that... right now, you don't really have a shopping cart with you. You have a sort of a carry-all device that you're using to carry your stuff. But police went after you because you had a shopping cart?
Yes, well, I had been recycling in the city for approximately a year and had asked permission to pull bottles and cans from the local street police. And they didn't indicate that there was anything wrong with them. Had saw a cart when I first came and picked one up and was had started in like I had in Monterey.
How long ago was this?
Over a year ago. Uh-huh. Yeah. And maybe about now, I guess it's been about 2 years. So I had been in a year, I had been all over the place with the thing. It's
a Safeway card or a Thrifty card?
Lucky's.
But not lucky for you.
No. Had even been to Lucky's. They had come out of the store and seen it. Had said nothing. And because I guess several of the gentlemen who also do recycling had indicated that they often go to the store and make purchases with their money that they receive from recycling. So one day out of the blue, one of the officers all of a sudden decided that it was not the thing to do and jerked the cart. Took my personals with him. I kept asking him not if I couldn't take off my personal belongings.
What's the name of this officer? Do you remember?
I don't remember.
Where did it happen?
Just about where we're at, Church Street, I guess. I guess that's it. And there were two officers. One didn't seem to bother him, and he wouldn't let me have them. And
was this during the day or at night?
No, it was during the day. I had taken off. I had some paperwork. He was going to even take that, but I got that.
Did he say that if someone had made a complaint, that Lucky's made a complaint? Or?
No, he didn't indicate that anyone had made a complaint.
And did you ever get your stuff back?
Not the personals. No.
And were you charged with a crime?
And it was never even for taking a car. But I had...
Were you taken to jail?
Booked. Yeah.
And what
yeah.
were you charged with? What was the alleged crime?
I guess a misdemeanor.
And it never reached the court calendar or it was dismissed?
He put me on probation. The judge did.
So you pled guilty?
No, I pled implied consent, which meant that...
No contest, you mean? Or?
Well, I told the judge, under law, implied consent is that if... You have if no one has said anything to you, then you imply that in a year, and I had attached to the student turned out to be a student attorney, all the receipts from all over showing that I had been in the area. I'd been active even at Lucky's. I had receipts from Lucky's.
Which judge were you? Was this all before?
I believe it was Judge Attack.
Judge Attic?
Attic, yeah.
And what did he say to you?
He didn't say too much, just that it was illegal. And that,
how long did he put you on probation for?
A year.
And what was the sentence he gave you in addition to that?
That was it. Yeah, it was suspended.
And when did this probation happen?
How long has it been? About 3 months ago, I guess.
So when do you get off probation?
In a year.
So if you're caught with a shopping cart, they can jail you for up to a year now?
I guess so, yeah. So I said, he said, don't touch another one, and I have it. But I thought that was interesting, that you could have a cart.
How did your public defender do? Did she do very well for you?
Well, I had a public defender, and they had switched me to... a student.
Public defender.
Yes, which was interesting.
Do you remember her name or his name?
No, I don't.
How many hours in court, all in all, did you spend with this stuff?
Oh, not long.
Did you get a jury trial?
No, I didn't.
Did you ask for one?
No.
Would you have preferred one?
Well, with the climate that there is in the city, I don't know if it would have done much good. So,
I don't know. I don't either. I'm not on trial myself, at least in this occasion, but there are a number of people who are going to trial shortly, and
yeah.
they're looking for a jury trial. So they're not homeless on the streets. They're just sort of activists who favor the rights of homeless people. So,
yes.
So I don't know what to say. Anything more you want to say about this to Free Radio?
Well, just that I think that if it is an ordinance or it's against the law, that they ought to, if they see you doing an illegal act, ought to say something in the beginning, not wait a year or two to finally...
Is there a shopping cart crisis in town? Have you seen every third person or every second homeless person
no.
running around with a shopping cart? Is that the problem?
And it really hurt, because that's how I was making my meals and personals. So I had to go from that to something else, which is interesting.
Heroin sales.
No, not...
Just kidding, folks.
Not heroin sales. And I think that what I don't quite understand of the court is how, when it's faced with law that is supposed to structure our society, how they can somehow become hoodwinked somehow to not seeing that or listening to it, but going along with some other preconcept, which I don't quite understand yet.
Because they want to enforce the power of the police regardless of the justice of the particular case.
Because I still don't see what the point is having law if you're not going to uphold it in a court, you know. If the law hadn't been set there, which says an implied consent, that if there is no...
if they're not going after you for the year and they seem to see it's okay, then they can't suddenly go after you the next day and say it's not. Sure.
Wouldn't you assume that? I mean, I guess nothing should be assumed, but if they're seeing you running around with the thing...
It sounds completely unreasonable. It's called actually equitable estoppel. That's the name of the defense. It's a legal term. And, you know, the problem is you probably didn't have competent defense, and it sounded like Attic didn't give you a jury trial. I don't think a jury would have been so hostile to you. Even if they believe the law was broken, one of the jurors can just say, no way I'm going to give this woman a chance to go to jail for up to 6 months, if that's what misdemeanor is.
Yeah.
And you can face now jail up for a year, I'm not sure. It's either a year or 6 months, depending on how long your original suspended sentence was for, probably 6 months. I was just talking to Jim up there, as being hassled, as I was telling you, for peacefully sitting there with a sign seeking spare change, apparently under new rules promulgated by Officer Lefebvre. And he, too, talks about this Santa Cruz City sleeping ban as really being an onerous imposition on him. He can't legally sleep at night. Are you finding similar problems? Or? Or are you okay? You found your...
Well, I found... Yeah, I guess I'm okay. I don't know. I guess we'll find out later.
Well, thank you very much.
All right.
Take care, Patricia.
Thank you.
And about 5 days later, the latest report from Jim, who you can find often in front of the Cinema 9 Theater, with a sign and a book and copies of Street Spirit. The new April edition of Street Spirit is out, by the way. If you want to read it, go by and buy it from him. It's only $1, and it's well worth the money. It's out of Oakland, but it has long stories on San Francisco, on Santa Cruz, as well as San Francisco. Jim's latest report is that he has not been harassed in the last 5 days, so that's good news. But there's good news and bad news. Let's hear some good news of a sort from Julia Vinograd and her audio tape, Eye of the Hand. More poetry from the Bubble Woman of Berkeley.
Drumming. You gotta get to the place where you can't stop, where you've always been drumming. Ache and beat and knee clutch and snarl and grin and curse and the sweet sweat rolls down like rain in the desert. You gotta get to the drumming place inside the bones of the drum, inside the cracked marrow of the bones of the drum, inside the cracked marrow of the bones of your hands. It's the same place inside. You gotta get there. Train whistle inside a wine bottle going round. Barefoot dancers carry your luggage. Polished boots stamp your ticket all the way. A brass horn announces the weather you'll be riding through. 98% chance of a heavy blues front with occasional lightning bolts and lovers and partial clearing in time for the end of the world. But all that doesn't matter. All that's just on the way to the drumming place where you can't stop, where you won't come back, where you've been all your life and only sent your ghost out to take care of business, though everyone thought it was you. And you believed them sometimes. Not now. You gotta get to the drumming place made of muscle and God and wood. You gotta leave all your memories behind on an answering machine on the moon when you hear the beep, when you hear the beat. You gotta stick the cracked marrow from the bones of the heart you're pounding on inside, inside. Orphan hate. There is more and more orphan hate around. Usually, hatred's almost an identity. We know who we are by who we hate. Politicians, the other football team, the weather, the person standing ahead in line, a tone of voice, a busy phone, cold coffee, the next morning, etc. But sometimes, hate explodes like a violent sneeze in church or the heart puking at nothing, at random. A street crazy twists his face up in corkscrew disgust, spitting out curses and waving disconnected fists at random. And on the highways, people sane enough to buy cars and get driving licenses and follow traffic signs shoot out their windows at random. I hope they are looking to kill God or the devil or their own true love. Any of the above would do. Because if they are just looking to kill anyone, we are all truly orphans. It's not that I want to turn this lost hatred to love. That's another problem for another poem. But I'd like to pin notes on people the way mothers do on very small children before sending them outside. Hello, my name is Hate, and this is my address. If I'm lost, please take me home to my mother who hates me. Thank you. At least it would be a beginning.
If you'd like to buy a copy of Julia Vinograd's latest book, Cannibal Carnival, it's $5 from Zeitgeist Press, 1630 University Avenue, number 34, Berkeley, California, 94703. And grab a pencil and I'll repeat that address. We're talking about Julia Vinograd's poetry, her largest collection ever, which is really very cheap, $5 paperback book for a collection of poetry, 1986 to 1996. And the address to get it is Zeitgeist Press, 1630 University Avenue, number 34, Berkeley, California, 94703. Really some wonderful poetry. Now, what I often do on Bathrob Spears Broadsides, which is what you're listening to on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, which you are tuned to, if you can hear my voice, what I often do during this two-hour stretch, it's 2 hours a day, often an hour and a half, is give you updates on what's happening in the courts. And as many of you regular listeners know, the City Hall Sleepers protest from last year, which lasted for a period of 7.5 months and resulted in more than 370 citations for sleep, crime, and other related protest offenses, many of these cases are now reaching the courts. And indeed, the hardcore cases, the cases involving misdemeanors, crime punishable by up to 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine, are coming in for trial, including the City Hall Sleepers protest, which, as you may remember from, if you listened last week, is the case of the chain gang lockdown folks who, on September 10th of last year, chained themselves to the furniture of the City Council in order to dramatize the situation for homeless people who were locked to the sleeping ban law and yet had no legal place to sleep, no place to hide, and yet no place to be legal. It's a dilemma, and it's a dilemma now where there are less than 30 sleeping spaces for more than 750 homeless people and no action whatsoever coming out of City Council in spite of the hopeful March 4th City Council study session, or I should say special session, which Scott Kennedy engineered, but unfortunately we haven't heard much from Scott in the last month on this issue, and less from Mayor Matthews, who was also supposed to be following through on different suggestions that came out of this six-hour session of City Council. I, of course, suggested at the time that the session was little more than a camouflage token effort designed to placate the three members of Council who were muzzled by Councilmember Rotkin in December and again in January, when these three members tried to raise the issue of changing and modifying the city's anti-homeless sleeping ban law, which makes sleeping and covering up with blankets after 11 o'clock at night illegal within city limits if you're doing it outside, and make sleeping in vehicles illegal. So instead of getting some real action, real discussion, real democracy, real concern with basic human rights for the poor, we had 6 hours of blather and some good intentions, and now weeks and weeks of nothing. No campground action. I understand Community House is dead in the water, hasn't been audited yet. I don't even know if an auditor has been selected to do that. I heard from Tim Reynolds of the who handles the federal state CDBG funding, which is the money that's going to this trailer project. The Community House project is a project that's replacing a campground that used to serve at its maximum 200 to 300 people free, in the sense that the people didn't have to pay to go there. Now it's going to cost like $600 a month, although people will be subsidized to some extent, and will handle only 40 people if and when it gets built. But there's been so much, I don't want to say scandal and corruption because that gives the wrong impression, but the project has been delayed endlessly since it began in 91, 92, and since it has frequently been used to push homeless people off the property there, and right now the property lies vacant at Coral Street, which could be used for a homeless campground, and the council is doing nothing. And in the meantime, trials are mounting up in the courts, and this week Sandria Roth went to find out what would happen with her misdemeanor sleeping crime jury trial, which would be the first of its kind. And Commissioner Salazar illegally, in my view, reduced her charges so she couldn't go to trial, so she couldn't bring her case before a jury, so she couldn't have the benefit of a public defender, and dismissed the case, and then sentenced her to $162 a ticket on more than 10 sleeping tickets that she'd been found liable for last year for sleeping at the City Hall Sleepers protest. That's, what is it, over $1,500. That's around $1,900 and something that she's going to have to pay. All of this, of course, without the benefit of a jury who might decide that sleeping is not something that they want to punish, as indeed the jury found in one of, in her earlier case, and with along with five other defendants in the sleep crime chain gang lockdown case I just spoke of. The jury hung, that is to say, they could not unanimously agree to a guilty verdict. Two jurors refused on one count, and one juror refused on the second count. The counts were trespass on public property. Yeah, this sounds like an oxymoron, but there you are. And disrupting a public assembly for disrupting the city council meeting of September 10th in the chain gang protest. So Sandy Roth lost her opportunity to have those cases, have her misdemeanor sleeping case brought to trial. And hopefully that's going to be appealed, and we'll see what happens with that one. There will be misdemeanor sleeping cases coming up in later.
Would you like a flyer? He's, you know, you're not supposed to hand out flyers. And I said, no, that's only to unwilling participants, which is a municipal code, that if I try to hand you a flyer and you don't want it, and I continue to try to hand you a flyer, then that's in violation of this municipal code. Mm-hmm. So he didn't know that. And so Seeley, young Seeley, had to take him aside there and educate him on the law.
Did you get the blessings of the Christian group for having helped?
Yeah, they started handing out their flyers. So
did they give you a peanut butter sandwich?
No, I did. I was already full of food. Anyway, I was handing out flyers, and so then they didn't bother me. Bye, Vincent. So I kept handing out flyers, and then we got into the discussion, and then I finally told people that only if it's to unwilling participants, and then the cops finally agreed that that was true. But they were relying on people's ignorance.
So you saved the city from a hefty lawsuit.
I was hoping I'd get charged.
Did you get a percentage of reward for that?
The way to do that would have been to say nothing and to begin to hand out flyers. You apparently blew your case there.
Well, you never know. At least I was there to help Officer Young inform himself. Now he's a better police officer because of this incident.
When did you get a job with the police department, Bob?
Even though he hates me from Campbell Street, I'm there to help him be a better cop.
Chumming around with these cops is jading your sensibilities here.
Well, we had a discussion about the needle exchange program, which has also had to stop their needle exchange under the Broadway Bridge for, I think, Friday, Saturday, and Sundays.
And who was responsible for stopping that?
Santa Cruz Police moves them along.
Was it particular police officers or a policy statement from above?
I think it's like a... It's not really a documented thing, but I think they were telling their officers if they see needle exchange under the bridge to move them along. And they have been doing that. Needle exchange just does whatever the police tell them to do. And so they move along. So I was trying to discuss with the cops about how it's a harm reduction and how they don't seem to understand that needle exchange is a life-saving program. They don't understand it. They're totally against it.
Which police officers did you speak to?
Lefebvre and then young Seeley said it's the same thing as me handing you bullets. It's like, not quite. You know, needles and bullets.
Bullets are legal, you know, I mean, that's strangely true. Enough.
Bullets are legal. Anyway, so we got in a little discussion, which I played on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
So. Oh, excellent, excellent. So you're scooping me again, eh, Bob?
Scooping you again.
So what about you? Actually, we've heard that there were actually misdemeanor charges filed against Needle Exchange, what, several months ago, and then those were dropped?
They're being very quiet about that, and I've been trying to contact them. They've been very quiet about that whole incident.
Jane Kaiser, come over here and be interviewed. Come on. We have another victim here in court today. This is Jane Kaiser with Patients Inmates Rights Collective, who was attending a conservatorship hearing of some poor soul about 2 months ago when she was, shall we say, interrupted in her progress toward the court by Deputy Fitzgerald, Steve Fitzgerald, who is actually still on the metal detector. Apparently he hasn't been removed. And here you are again. What's happening today?
Well, this is a pretrial hearing
for the incident that happened on that day, and then I guess 2 or 3 weeks later, right?
Yeah, on Valentine's Day.
So you actually had your marijuana seized by this, was it the same deputy in both cases?
Yes, and the card, and
you had your medical marijuana card taken, and the first incident involved some violence, didn't it?
Yeah, my, I don't want to talk about it right now, though. I'm just kind of worn out.
It's okay. I was a witness to it, and as I remember, you were grabbed forcibly when you tried to retain your card. Your hands were pulled behind your back, twisted, and you were handcuffed, and about 7 deputies came rushing out of the courts and made a huge hullabaloo about it. Of course, I made a hullabaloo, too, because I felt it was an improper arrest. The whole thing looked like utter harassment, and I can't stand that metal detector to start with. I think it's a complete bogus, phony security thing, which actually simply removes the privacy rights of people here in the courts. Anything you want to say to the free radio audience, Jim?
No.
Thank you very much, and good luck today. Well, we're speaking to
Steve McWilliams of the Pikes Peak Hemp Coalition.
And Steve, you just heard my interview with Jane Kaiser, and this brought to mind something else.
Yes, just the other day in front of the police chief's office downtown in Santa Cruz, I met another sister in the cause who's a Buyers Club member, and she had been assaulted by the police and her marijuana confiscated and her hands tied behind her back with handcuffs and her wrists were all bruised, and she's a disabled woman in her 40s or so. Clearly not.
What color hair did she have?
She had fairly long, dark reddish hair.
And do you remember what any distinguishing characteristics that might help us place her name?
I think her name might have been Jamie, and but I do know that she's a club member and had just come from the club, and she was clearly very upset that had been treated the way that she had been.
You know which cops were involved in this?
No, I really we just happened to meet. I'd never seen her before, and the way I happened to see her was that I was putting our Pikes Peak Hemp Coalition newsletters under the windshield wipers of police cars in front of the police station, and Police Chief Belcher drove up with his wife in his personal car and asked me not to do that, and I told him I had the free speech right to do that and left it, and this sister was very happy, so I gave her one of our bumper stickers.
Did she give you admission, no name, no address, nothing at the moment?
Well, I think we talked for a little bit, and she gave me her name, but, you know, short-term memory loss and all of that.
Ah, the deadly weed strikes again, folks. Let this be a lesson to us all.
Well, the deadly thing that's happening, I just came from San Diego and Tijuana down there working with the coalition, and things are desperate at the border, and we're sure to see a lot more trouble coming from down south. We're building an iron curtain across Mexico. We're building a system of apartheid where people are questioned and pulled over and harassed and driven off the road and shot by the police simply for the color of their skin and the language that they speak.
Does this have to do with marijuana, or does it have to do with simply immigration?
Well, immigration, marijuana, heroin. You know, a lot of the people that are San Diego cracked down so hard around its area that a lot of the people are moving now to the eastern counties and Texas and New Mexico and Arizona. And as they come across these poor people, just to have something, they're bringing marijuana with them in huge bundles or heroin with them. This is not that they're actually drug runners, but they have to have a way to finance their trip, and they can't carry a lot with them, so they're doing the best they can. And our courts and jails are filling up, and it's the poor people who go to jail. The rich people have the lawyers and walk away. It's a desperate situation, it'll just continue to get worse as time goes on.
Thank you, Steve. If folks want to get in touch with you to help distribute literature or help your cause in some other way, what can they do here in Santa Cruz?
Well, we try and put our newsletters out to places like the different coffee houses and boutiques all around town.
Cafe Pergolesi?
Yes, and the one right down here in town, what is this, the Cafe Java. We try and keep our newsletters
out.
Java House.
Java House. Which I'm barred, of course, but that's another matter.
Well, we try and keep our newsletters out, and we'd love to have people read it, pass it on.
So look for the Pikes Peak newsletter and...
Hemp Coalition.
Hemp Coalition. Maybe there's a number on that newsletter for them to contact.
Right. There's subscriptions and all kinds of good information, what's happening with the medical marijuana and the marijuana movement around the nation, industrial hemp as well.
Do you have a local number people can call?
No, I don't. And our agent...
You can call 423-HUFF. If you're interested in the subject, I'll try to pass it on to Steve if and when I see it.
Great. Thank you very much, Robert.
It's around 10:05 on April 10th. We're talking to...
Robert Bowser.
And your first name again is?
Robert.
Robert. And Robert, what's happened? Did you say where you were pushed in the river by the cops?
Yeah. I did an exchange for cigarettes for a pack of matches, and they thought I did a drug deal or something. And it was kind of dark, and I just heard a bunch of running, and took off running and ended up getting pushed in the river.
And when was this?
A little while back. I'm going to go take a break. I'll talk to you a little bit later about it.
Sounds good. One area of concern for folks challenging the sleeping ban and trying to fight other anti-homeless laws is the lack of enthusiasm and the elitist policies of public defenders and court-appointed attorneys who, first of all, of course, are part of the attorney caste, and so they have their own sort of set of rules and regulations, their own perspective on things. They regard themselves as sort of an elite group of professionals who should be deferred to in this matter of their expertise. While frequently they don't really understand what goes on in political trials, they don't understand what the defendants are trying to do, which is a combination of things. Certainly they're not trying necessarily to go to jail, though in some cases, I guess, that can be a strategy that's used. But frequently what they're doing is they're trying to use a combination, a variety of strategies to pressure public authorities into meeting basic human rights requirements. In Santa Cruz, the issue of the sleeping ban has been an ongoing one for the last decade, where a city ordinance that criminalizes sleeping outside after 11 and covering up with blankets has been coexisting with the reality of no shelter space for 95% of the homeless people in the area, and seeming heavy contradiction. It means, of course, that those people are illegal. And ways to challenge this have varied from such things as public awareness and education campaigns, civil disobedience designed to clog the courts with cases, and encourage the judges to put pressure on city legislators, city council people, to change the law, to constitutional challenges, which have had some success in Southern California, or did several years ago, until they were truncated by the California Supreme Court in the Tobe decision. But attorneys, court-appointed attorneys and public defenders frequently want to run the show, and they have a rather narrow sense of what's best for their clients. And that was that's the subject of a long article I wrote in the Street Spirit for April, which, again, as you've heard before, is on sale downtown, being sold by homeless people. And if you're homeless, by the way, and you want to sell this newspaper, just give me a call at 423-HUFF, and I'll get you some copies to sell. It's a good paper. Anyway, in the recent trial of the sleep crime chain gang lockdown case, there was one defendant who was not present. His name was Joel Coates. And he wasn't present because, though he'd come all the way up from San Diego to be present at the trial, at least be present when his attorney was discussing the strategy and so forth and to talk to the other defendants, he decided he wanted his attorney to try the case with him not present because he didn't want to lose his job. He wanted to be able to continue working. And the arcane legal vindictiveness that was being used against him and the six other defendants for a five-minute demonstration in September of 1996, completely justified, completely nonviolent, and now the demonstration has cost the taxpayers $20,000 thanks to a vindictive DA, and will cost again that sum of money when they attempt to retry these folks, when they do retry them in June. Coates decided he wanted to save his job, and he suggested that they go ahead without him and that he be tried in absentia, which is an appropriate way to proceed, provided you tell the judge that's what's going on. His attorney was a man named Tony Salatich. Now, Salatich admitted to me later that he had never tried a political trial, and apparently he made numerous derogatory comments to Coates about the defendants, about Coates' strategy and so forth, which of course is his free speech right, but it is his responsibility to represent Coates and to express to the court what Coates wants done and what Coates wanted done. Instead of doing that, instead of saying that Coates wanted to be tried in absentia and making a motion to that effect in court before Judge Tom Kelly, he simply said his client had not shown up and a warrant went out for his arrest. Coates lost his job down south, had to come back here, and here you're going to hear the story in his own words. Now, when I interviewed the attorney on this issue, he said that he had spoken to the judge the night before and tried to work out a possible deal. Coates had informed the attorney he didn't want a deal worked out. He simply wanted the attorney to try him without his being present. That's what he wanted done. And he informed the attorney he would not be present. Well, apparently, the attorney, instead of making the appropriate motion for a continuance or for a trial in absentia, simply told the judge he couldn't get in touch with Coates, and the judge issued an arrest warrant. The attorney claimed that he talked to the judge the night beforehand and told him all the alternatives, but other attorneys in the case and Coates and other witnesses tend to agree that this is an example of public defenders at their worst. And this is something that it's really hard for clients to deal with. People who are new to these situations don't know what their legal rights are, and they are put in a position where they feel they have to rely on attorneys. What we really need, of course, is a legal collective for homeless people, which shows homeless people and homeless advocates how to use the law library, which works with sympathetic attorneys who essentially take direction from the clients instead of trying to direct, manage, and plea bargain away the client's rights. Here's an interview by Joel Coates on this issue, at least on his particular case.
Keep it, at least. I pleaded my case with my lawyer, Mr. Tony Salatich, that's with a capital S. And I explained to him, would it be okay if I waive my right not to show up and for him to represent me while I'm down there? He said yes. So I went down there.
He didn't indicate there would be any problem with this?
Oh, no, he indicated there would be a big problem. Not necessarily with that, but what a dead-end trial this was and how we're definitely going to be found guilty by the full extent of the law. That's what he had a problem with.
Did he indicate you didn't seem to want to go to trial with it?
Huh? Did I indicate I didn't want to go to trial?
No, did he indicate he didn't want to go to
trial? Oh, yeah, repeatedly.
And your response to that was?
Boy, I'm so lucky to have him. So what occurred was I went down to San Diego, and a few days after I was down there, Mr. Salatich called me and said, well, Judge Kelly didn't like that idea. You got a warrant for your arrest now. So now I had to quit my job and come back up here, and I'm waiting.
And you've dealt with a warrant?
Correct.
I wrote a story about this issue for the Street Spirit. It'll be coming out tomorrow or the next day, an Oakland newspaper. And I didn't name Salatich by name because I hadn't been able to talk to you personally. I did talk to a few people who witnessed, who had conversations with you, Daniel Hopkins and Sandra Roth, before this happened, to the effect that you had asked Salatich specifically to represent you in absentia while you were gone, and that he didn't like the idea, but you had made that particular request. And in declining to do that, or let's put it this way, in not making a lot of positive efforts to do that, he misrepresented you. He put you in a position of some jeopardy. He didn't do the right thing.
Well, he was more than happy to give me a monologue about how we're wasting taxpayers' money and how we're a bunch of two-bit punk loser kids and we don't know what the hell we're doing and we should do it his way or no way, blah, 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 blah.
I spoke to Salatich. I left a message on his machine last week saying there's been a charge of malfeasance against you in this trial by by some of the people observing it. I wasn't able to talk to you, so I didn't know if you were charging him with that. He called me back immediately, and he went into this long rap about how he had warned you that Kelly would get very angry and would not allow this, and that he had told you all the alternatives beforehand the night before you went back to court in the Sleep Crime Chain Gang lockdown case, or he went back to court, and that he had fully expected you to show up, and he had no idea you wouldn't show up, even though you had mentioned that might happen. And then when Kelly...
No, I mentioned that it would happen.
And he then said that he did not have time to tell Kelly
to make a formal motion that you, he be allowed to represent you in absentia, because Kelly said issue an arrest warrant, and that was that.
Oh, how convenient.
But I have, I'm going to actually, the attorneys present, including who I don't want to name at the moment because I don't know if they want to be, said that it was a disgraceful performance and it was inappropriate in terms of representing your own interests. And I'm ticked at the whole defense of, this, of the sleep crime chain gang lockdown case for different reasons. Salatich continued to insist that you insisted that I, for example, personally not be involved in any way as a witness or as a...
Wait, who said this?
Attorney Salatich.
No, that's false. That's incorrect.
I hope I'm quoting him properly.
Yes.
He claimed he had no... Did he make any statements about me to you, by the way, in the course of your relationship with him?
I honestly can't recall.
So nothing comes to mind.
All right.
So, in fact, it may have been another attorney that said that, but he did say that... He had discussed with you all the alternatives and that he expected you to show up the next morning and never thought you wouldn't show up.
He knew for a fact that I wasn't showing up. He knew for a fact that he was supposed to represent me when I was not going to arrive the next day. He knew for a fact this was going to occur, and he was going to waive the motion for him to represent me. Apparently it didn't occur that way.
Now, he also claims that he made numerous attempts to contact you but had no phone number for you prior to the trial. Down south.
He claimed to have lost my phone number down in San Diego twice, okay? On top of that, repeatedly contacting me down in San Diego? No. He recontacted me twice down in San Diego. Once to tell me, okay, I got the right number, and once to tell me, oh, you have a warrant for your arrest, and by the way, I think you guys are a bunch of punk loser kids, and I think you're wasting taxpayers' money. Yes.
A candid man, Tony Salatich. But before the trial, did he ever contact you? He claimed he had no number for you and hence was unable to reach you prior to the trial.
That's incorrect. I gave him two numbers right when I first met the guy. And not only that, on the second occasion that I went to court up here, I went ahead and gave him another two numbers. And apparently, that wasn't enough and he lost them both times.
An absent-minded attorney, perhaps.
Correct. Yeah. Oh, very busy.
So prior to the first trial, let's say, you know, in the months prior...
You want me to give you a quote from him when I first met the guy?
Yes.
Okay, here it is. Hi, my name's Tony Salatich. I'm a big-time defending lawyer. You're really lucky to have me. See, usually I handle rape and murder cases.
You said the same thing to me on the phone.
Yeah, usually I handle rape and murder cases. So, you know, this is just totally inconvenient for me, and I don't even know why they appointed me to begin with. He goes, but you're just real lucky to have me. You're really lucky to have me.
At that point, you should have immediately gone to the judge and said, thank you, but no thank you.
Yeah, well, I was naive, and I thought his $2,000 suit meant something.
It certainly did, apparently.
Yeah, he gets overpaid, and he was more than happy to tell me how much he got paid while representing me when he didn't do squat. He gets paid like $150 a day or something.
And that was defendant Joel Coates, who was returned to Santa Cruz to face an arrest warrant and was unable to be tried with the other City Hall sleepers protesters who got a hung jury. He probably would have gotten a hung jury as well had he been tried with them. But now he faces either a separate trial or a retrial with an additional charge of failing to appear thanks to the, I have to say it, apparent malfeasance of his attorney, Tony Salatich. But the issues really are broader than this. Public defenders and court-appointed attorneys don't take the time, don't do the investigations necessary, and don't really understand the theory behind political cases a lot. And that's what I'm hoping that we can get together information sheets, we can get together sort of written material so that those public defenders and court-appointed attorneys who really would like to understand the political cases and defend them to the best of their ability and learn as they proceed will be able to do that. So that's a prospect in the months ahead, because these trials, whether they're resolved by plea bargains or no contest pleas or guilty pleas or whatever, are not the first. I mean, certainly not the first, but they're also not the last, because with the ongoing sleeping ban, protests are going to arise again and again from different groups of people, because this is an outrageous situation which really enrages and offends basic human decency and the conscience.
First name's on me.
Michael.
Michael, you're a formerly homeless guy who's now got a trailer?
Yes.
And how long have you had that trailer?
About 4 months.
And how long before that were you homeless?
About 6 months.
And
There's been some concerns that trailer parks are, some of them anyway, are kind of either gouging the renters or deliberately trying to oust them by posing unrealistic restrictions on them, things of that sort.
Changing these restrictions, changing from when you move in, then changing the rules so that you don't fit.
And has this happened to you?
They're trying, yeah.
And what kind of changes are they trying to make?
Well, we moved in with dogs, now they say no dogs. They said $350 a month, now they want $475 a month, which is almost, I can't hardly afford that. So it just keeps kind of going up and up and up. So
you mind giving the name of the trailer park?
No, I wouldn't want to do that, because then I would be out.
Is it inside Santa Cruz or outside?
Inside.
So isn't there rent control for trailer parks inside Santa Cruz?
I have no idea.
You might consider going to city council members and telling them that you feel there's a problem and ask or talk to them in confidence about it.
Came from Tacoma, Washington.
We came from Tacoma, Washington. We were here about 24 hours, pulled alongside the road, and they ran us off. The sheriff ran us off the side of the road, so we couldn't sleep there.
Which is it's not true. It is actually legal to rest by the side of the road outside the city limits.
Really? We were on Highway 9.
Were you outside the city limits?
Yeah, we were up.
So the sheriff's deputies were lying to you.
Yeah, basically. And then they said that, we said, well, where can we go sleep? They said rent a motel room, which were $100-something-odd a night. Mm-hmm. So we drove up to this rest area they have here on Highway 1, I believe it is. Mm-hmm. And so we pulled in there thinking we could sleep for an hour or two, and there's a 20-minute limit. So we barely got our eyes closed, and they pulled in, said, how long have you been here, and blah, 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 and ran us off out of there. So we had nowhere to go. We pulled into
these the same deputies or somebody else?
Somebody else, yeah. Right. It was actually Highway Patrol then. And then we pulled into a church parking lot and slept there, and by next morning we had the sheriffs there saying we couldn't sleep there either. So
this was a church inside Santa Cruz or outside?
I believe outside, up by Capitola. It's up on a hill with the big three crosses.
And had there been a complaint from the people running the church, or were the sheriffs just running around? Did they tell you there was a complaint?
No.
So it sounds like, did these deputies indicate that they kind of knew, were they passing on the word from police agency to police agency, or was it just generally a program?
I think they just patrolled the area as soon as Sarah said, what are you doing? We said, we're sleeping. They said, you can't do that. So we packed it up, moved on. So there was like no place to sleep. I mean, you know, it could have caused an accident as tired as I was to be driving. You know, I needed some sleep. We had just driven up from, last place we slept was Oregon. By the time we got here, and we needed somewhere just to lay our heads, you know. We couldn't afford $100-something they wanted for a motel room, even if you could have found a motel room. So then we went up to Henry Cow, rented a spot there on a Thursday, and they booted us out on a Friday because they're all booked up for the weekends through the season. So we were like stuck. Then we went down to the Homeless Resource Center, and they helped us out quite a bit. They gave us ideas and places to, you know, get food and check things
out.
How
about sleeping? Did they give you places to sleep?
No, they didn't. They did offer up a shelter, ISSP shelter, but it was full. Mm-hmm. And it was me.
What night was this when it was full, more or less? What month?
Oh, goodness. December?
So the Winter Armory, the Winter Armory was full in December?
When did I get here? I got here July, so it would have been July. It would have been late July, excuse me. Okay. Yeah,
so
we
got here in July. There was no.
There was really nothing we could do. But see, we were, as a family, it was me, my girlfriend, and a 12-year-old boy. And for us to do the shelter program they had, we had to be separated. And we just wouldn't do that.
But there was no room anywhere.
There was no room anywhere.
You know, there are a number of cases coming up that hinge on the evidence that there was inadequate shelter space for people coming to the shelters, and therefore people had no choice but to sleep illegally. Would you be willing to testify at such a trial if this happened to you?
Oh, sure.
Okay, well, off mic, I'll get your number and I'll call you on that.
Okay. All right.
Mm-hmm,
no problem. Yeah.
Ginsburg. No blame. Anyone who wrote Howl and Kaddish earned the right to make any possible mistake for the rest of his life. I just wish I hadn't made this mistake with him. It was during the Vietnam War, and he was giving a great protest reading in Washington Square Park, and nobody wanted to leave. So Ginsburg got the idea. I'm going to shout, "The war is over," as loud as I can, he said. And all of you run over the city in different directions, yelling the war is over, shouted in offices, shops, everywhere. And when enough people believe the war is over, why, not even the politicians will be able to keep it going. I thought it was a great idea at the time, a truly poetic idea. So when Ginsburg yelled, I ran down the street and leaned in the doorway of the sort of respectable down-on-its-luck cafeteria where librarians and minor clerks have lunch, and I yelled, "The war is over!" and a little old lady looked up from her cottage cheese and fruit salad. She was so ordinary she would have been invisible except for the terrible light filling her face as she whispered, my son is coming home. I got myself out of there and was sick in some bushes. That was the first time I believed there was a war.
And I'm in the office of Gary Amani, who is the staff member, one of two actually, who is on the Citizens Police Review Board. Gary actually does the nuts and bolts work along with Donna of taking complaints from citizens, from individuals who feel they've suffered some abuse by police or have a complaint. And he's going to... Now, you've come up with an interesting idea that sounds quite like it cuts through the Gordian knot of the tangle that we've had regarding this office's function as a kind of an archive for people who have filed complaints against the police department and want to have access, other members of the public who want access to those complaints to see what a record of a particular officer is, at least in terms of complaints filed, and what, in fact, is going on between the community and the police department in terms of the nature of the complaints filed. You currently, under state law, have been told that you are not allowed to show those complaints. They become confidential. So in essence, when an individual makes a complaint, it is sort of wrapped up in a censored secret file, goes to the police department, and all the public gets to see is a sort of a vague description of the complaint with the officer's name deleted. Is that currently the current status?
That's correct. State personnel rules preclude us from distributing the complaint.
It's in the police officers or the public safety officers' Bill of Rights.
That's a recent amendment to the Bill of Rights, or longstanding?
No, this is longstanding.
So we've been trying to find some ways around it. One way I've suggested is to file a claim with the city, which then becomes a public document, and then eventually reaches the file and becomes an open document because it was filed publicly with the city. But the problem with that, as you pointed out, is this stalls the whole process for 6 or more months, or can. And so you've come up with another idea. Can you tell us what that idea is?
Well, this isn't a new idea. The complainant has always been free to distribute their copy of the complaint to anybody they want to. So if they want to take it down to the paper, and the paper wants to publish it, the paper's free to do that. So in a sense, then it becomes a public document. What I suggest is that if somebody wants to see that their complaint is documented in a public file here at the office, they bring their complaint to a public board meeting. The board meets once a month, the second Monday of every month at 5 o'clock in the City Council chambers. Give it to the board, say, I filed this complaint, I want to make sure you all have a copy of it. There, then the complaint becomes part of the public documents of that meeting, and it would be stored as such. So the complaint would be stored in the files here, the public files, with all of the other documents that go along with that public meeting.
So instead of being simply a one-page kind of description that a complaint has been filed, any member of the public could actually see the full complaint, the officer's name, and I guess the one thing you could also see the disposition of that complaint if you cross-filed it with the original description of the complaint that you get. We don't get to see the original complaint.
No, right. The disposition would be also public because that is public information.
Right.
We've always made the dispositions public. What the board
Although
says.
We don't know the disciplinary consequences of that disposition.
No, and we don't either.
It all is a secret, folks, hidden in the police department labyrinthine files. So perhaps the officer gets promoted like Sergeant Baker, or it gets declared Officer of the Year after 10 complaints of sexual abuse against the citizenry. There's also apparently a set of criterion that have been set up for independent investigation, which I believe is one of the ways you suggested when we last spoke would be a good way to strengthen the Citizens Police Review Board, that we provide regular independent investigation for certain kinds of complaints, or perhaps all complaints?
I certainly think independent investigation would add a lot of strength to the board because, one, the board would have control over the investigation, and two, the contents of the investigation and the results would be public information.
Now, in Berkeley, they do have independent investigation, and they do have public hearings, not just if requested, but as a matter of course. 3-member subcommittees of the Police Review Commission, as they call their Citizens Police Review Board, meet regularly to consider complaints. Although,
is there any move afoot in the CPRB, or do you personally feel, professionally, let's say, that it would be good to adopt the Berkeley system of regular public hearings and independent investigations?
Well, I don't know that much about how they
hold their public hearings, so with the system that we have here now, regular public hearings would, I don't see that it would be productive in any way. And I think a public hearing into...
you don't feel that the credibility of the process would be improved by the public knowing you could hear the discussion process, see the evidence, and observe the debate, hear the officers' testimony, see the people confront each other, so that they would know that there was a real investigation taking place and not something simply happening behind closed doors?
I don't deny any of that is valid, Robert. I'm just saying that here, from what I've seen so far, the types of complaints that have come in, there have been very, very few that I think have warranted a public hearing.
But in fact, no complaints have gotten a public hearing.
Right.
And how many have actually requested public hearings, if you remember offhand?
I believe you were the only one.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And that was a brief selection from an interview with Gary Yamane of the Citizens Police Review Board here in Santa Cruz in January. Since then, Gary has become even more pessimistic in his expectations of the board and his descriptions of how things are going. I've been pessimistic all along because the board is unwilling to deal with not just the toy poodle aspect of the board right now, where it has no power, but it's allowing even its minor powers to be eroded by decrees from Chief Belcher's office, which we've covered in past shows, such as the fact that Belcher now has declared that complaints coming into the department can be classified as inquiries at his discretion, and inquiries are not subject to CPRB review. If you're interested in watching a police review board meeting, assuming that they can get together a quorum to have one, and that's apparently doubtful, but because they're having problems with people who are quitting, they just won't stay in an ineffectual board, there is a meeting at 5 o'clock on Monday, April 14th, at City Hall, at the City Council Chambers. If you want to go to that, that's 5 o'clock, Monday the 14th. That will be tomorrow, if you're listening to this tape on Sunday. You can go and check out the CPRB. I generally don't go to these hearings anymore, because even though they do provide you with a lot of time to speak, it seems kind of senseless. It isn't televised. They don't respond to any of your criticisms. And I think the only purpose really in going to one of these meetings, other than to observe this process, would be if you had a bunch of people with real, loud, clear complaints that would sort of rock the chambers and cause some consequences in terms of the board realizing it had to listen to these folks because there were so many of them. But people in the black community, like Esther Bradley Delgado, who I spoke to at the Mumia rally, tend to feel that the board is completely ineffectual regarding complaints that the black community is filing. The homeless community, homeless complaints are not being upheld, so it's a serious, serious situation. And what it needs, of course, is mass organizing action to demand that the council, city council, take action to establish a real board with real advocates, or even more important, that we establish our own process of cop watch on the streets that deals with this issue. You've been listening to Bathrob Spears Broadsides on Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3 FM. The show comes on every Sunday at 11, hopefully, or soon thereafter, and maybe even repeats during the week at different times. You're listening to a tape. We would like to find a home for Free Radio Santa Cruz. If you have quarters for a radio station, even a small one, just a room in the back, give us a call. Give me a call at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. That's headquarters for Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and I'll pass the word on to the Free Radio staff. You can also give me a call if anything I've said in the show interests you and has provoked any thoughts on your part that you want to respond to. Mayor Matthews, please call in if you'd like. Same for you, Councilmember Rotkin. Dissenting opinion is welcome on this show. For those interested in homeless rights activities, we are attempting to defend the rights of activists coming up for trial and to press the fight against the sleeping ban and to press solidarity for those in other cities like Palo Alto, San Jose, Mountain View, Santa Barbara, perhaps even Berkeley, although Berkeley is heading in the positive direction while all those other cities are heading in a negative direction, as they fight anti-homeless laws that are hitting the books fast and furious. In Palo Alto on April 24th, there's going to be a demonstration, and we're going to run a caravan from the town clock at 5 o'clock. If you're interested in being a part of that caravan, give a call to 423-HUFF. We need cars, and if you want to go, you may need space. That's again April 24th. to Palo Alto, leaving at 5 o'clock for a peaceful demonstration to violate their sitting laws that will probably result in no arrest whatsoever, but that might, and you can choose at the time whether you want to engage in civil disobedience or not. You can come as a support person if you'd like. So to recap, and to give you a few new meeting times, today on Sunday, April 13th, at 7:30 at the Coffee Roasting Company in downtown Santa Cruz, we're going to be discussing jury nullification, the right of jurors to just say no to bad laws. A really important right for people facing the drug war, for homeless people facing harassment from city authorities and the district attorney. And at 8 o'clock on Sunday night, we hope to have with us Scott Wagers of the Community Homeless Alliance, San Jose. Scott is a pastor of sorts who has been actively fighting to expand housing and shelter space for homeless people in San Jose, which of course is a much larger population than Santa Cruz, and faces this vicious 66-block-wide sitting ban, which passed the first reading on Tuesday, last Tuesday. More on that ban in our next show. I hope to get some quotes. We actually got tapes from there, but we haven't been able to find them for this particular show. So that's on Sunday. That's today. Come on down to the Coffee Roasting Company at 7:30. And at 8 o'clock, get to meet Scott Wagers, we hope. Then on the 14th, 5 o'clock at City Hall, is the Citizens Police Review Board. Then on Tuesday, the 15th, at 5:30, homeless activists are getting together to discuss strategies for supporting Palo Alto and other cities, supporting activists in this city, and new plans to end the sleeping ban, because there is a city council meeting a week after that on the 22nd, April 22nd, 7 p.m. at City Hall, where we hope to show up in some numbers. So, if any of these things interest you, do show up. If you can't show up and want to support this stuff, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833. We hope to have a flyer out soon of all the court dates of folks going to these various sleep crime trials, so you can come to the ones you want to and support the folks that you think need supporting. If you need to know where and when, if I'm missing some of the details here in my hurry to get stuff mentioned, just give me a call, again, at the same number, 423-HUFF. And of course, if you have anything you've heard in the last 2 hours that you disagree with, that you want to add to, or perhaps stuff you haven't heard that you'd like to hear on the air about basic civil rights for poor people, do give a call to that same number, 423-4833. Likewise, if you see an instance of police abuse and you want to report that, or you feel that you're being harassed or denied basic rights in a homeless service, give me a call as well, and we can direct you to the proper channels to file a formal complaint. So we're going to be winding down now. I wish we could do some more reading from Julia Vinograd, whose Cannibal Carnival and Eye of the Hand, you've heard some selections from, mostly Eye of the Hand. You actually heard her reading. Her latest book is Cannibal Carnival. Unfortunately, my machine does not allow that because the whole thing gets distorted when it attempts to dub from another tape. So, hey, we're just going to have to live with it. If you're interested again in her writing and you didn't catch the address, just give me a call, 423-HUFF, and I will be happy to pass it on to you again. Also coming up on Tuesday, April 14th, in Santa Barbara, for those of you who happen to be traveling south or just want to follow such things, is another Sit on the Sidewalk, Go to Jail law, which we're going to be fighting. Again, trying to expand the California Resistance Network, which is essentially folks in different cities who have access to telephones and faxes and at the same time have some solidarity with people on the street, which is a rare combination, but it does happen at certain points. And what we're going to try to do is make sure that whenever any protests are organized in any city in California against anti-homeless laws or in favor of homeless rights, that there is a flood of material that comes into that city in support of that protest, provided we agree with it, and I think usually we will, in order to influence the authorities and show them that it's not simply three people on the street that are opposing it and two soft-headed social service providers, but bunches of people throughout the state, attorneys from San Francisco, activists from Los Angeles, lunatics from Santa Cruz, everybody's in favor of the right, for example, to sit down on the street, which is what will be contested on April 24th in Palo Alto on University Avenue, when there is going to be a nonviolent civil disobedience sit-down. And as I said, we'll be doing a caravan from the town clock, 5 or 5:15, on Thursday, April 24th, if you want to be a part of that. And of course, if you're interested in selling street spirit, you can again call 423-HUFF, and we'll set you up with some street spirits to to make some money on. That's what the idea is, to get out the news about homeless rights struggles and the main stories in Street Spirit Concern, those protests that are happening in Oakland, in Palo Alto, and here in Santa Cruz, the continuing sleep crime trial resistance, which is, well, quite a story. I suggest you read it. Great writer, Robert Norse, I think his name is. Front page of the Street Spirit. And now finally a poem from Julia Vinograd for Gypsy Who Died. I'd like to, I wish that Julia could read this herself, but unfortunately at this point in the tape her voice distorts when I try to dub her on, so you have to listen to me read it. For Gypsy Who Died. When I first heard, I laughed, a street girl told me. I said, gypsies die every year, don't you know? Gypsies can't die. And he can't. Not the man who drank so much he lost all his teeth and strung them on a necklace and danced in front of a scrawled graffiti that said, Lil Gypsy is an embarrassment to all street people. Grinning and drinking and dancing straight back and handsome till the necklace broke, and then dancing faster. And we danced with him. Not the man who stood patiently on his head while a friend asked passerby, could you spare a dime to get this man back on his feet? And when someone gave, Gypsy turned a somersault and laughed, fists raised triumphantly to the sky. Not the man who made himself a costume of harlequin leather patches and always wore his head as if his hat had an outlaw's plume, even when he didn't have a hat. He could swagger when he couldn't walk. Not the man who set fires and trash cans on fire, who caused every kind of trouble, including love, including laughter. Not the man who flew the Jolly Roger from the shopping cart that held all his belongings. Not the man who fought with everyone in between fights, his own body beat him up with epileptic seizures and Vietnam flashbacks, but life rejoiced in him. He was a shout sewn up in a skin. Gypsy could never be counted on is counting on us. As long as we give a cop the bird, as long as we plant a flower in People's Park, as long as we stand a friend to drink, as long as we laugh at trouble, Gypsy can't die. This is People's Park. This is People's Park, where tattooed fighters planted rose tattoos and roses grew blood red. It's not a peaceful place. The vines are tangled with our nerves. Grass untidy as a drunk's beard. Trees grow shopping carts. Bushes grow sleeping bags. Lilies of the valley smoke cigarettes. They just bum, but with such style. Here are sunflowers that'll steal your backpack when you're not looking. Daisies, crooked as game booths at the circus, and violets sticking out their impudent purple tongues. Or is that us? I don't know. It doesn't matter. When people come to Berkeley, they always ask to see People's Park, and when I show it to them, they don't see it. Next time, I'm not going to walk them a few blocks, watch their faces, and try to explain. Instead, I'll show them my hands. Here's People's Park, I'll say. Here. Spare changers. 20 on a block, and by the time you get to the end of the block, your innocence is gone. You're a horrible miser who lets people starve in front of you. You're guilty of the hawking cough and the plastic bag raincoat and the broken shopping cart packed with all that's left. It isn't much, and it's getting wet, and it's your fault it's raining, too. If you looked in the mirror, it would break with disgust. You couldn't spare a quarter? You were just walking down the street, minding your own business, maybe thinking about someone you just met and the light on their hair, and wondering if they liked you as much, when all of a sudden, there's this empty hand in your path. And you're a mass murderer, and there's no excuse. You can buy spare parts of your self-respect back from the spare changers, but the motor's broken for good. You can call the garage and get them to tow your conscience away. It doesn't work anymore. Nothing works anymore. And you want your innocence back. You have a right to the self you were before you walked down the block. You spent a whole life working at it. It's yours. And the homeless want their homes back. They have a right to the selves they were before. It's theirs. Whole lives broken. Whole lives blaming. One block. And Bathrobe Spears Broadsides, join me next Sunday at 11 p.m. at 96.